It is 8:30. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No Maria this week?
No, she's been tabbed by Timothy Geithner to write checks to big moguls on Wall Street. So she's been moving off to Washington, D.C. now, and we're
going through the interview process as we speak.
Yeah, the vetting process may hang her up, though, so she may actually be back in a week or two.
Yeah, so once they find
some
out.
Some of those unfortunate things that, well, we've known about for years, but we don't have the high standards here that they do in Washington, so.
Yes. All right. So moving on, starting with local. The looks like the
it is work related, by the way. But she will be back in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Or who knows? Possibly in another week or so. All right. So the Mayor Greg Nickels looks like he might actually have some competition for the mayors.
After months and months and months of speculation of is anybody credible going to run against Greg Nickels for mayor, we got not one but two challengers this week, and it just doesn't get there have to be progressives somewhere in Seattle's political establishment, but we're certainly not getting them running for mayor. There are two different announcements this week. The first was Mike McGinn, the former head of the Sierra Club, and any joy that was accompanied by, head of Sierra Club, good progressive, good environmentalist. Well, yes and no. There were several problems with his announcement, and bear in mind that McGinn is, a good liberal progressive Democrat, but he's going to have trouble distinguishing himself from Nickels on probably the key signature item that concerns many Seattleites, which is the development that's going on in the city and the neighborhood plans and the fact that many neighborhoods are having a great deal of additional density being proposed for them and built for them, far beyond anything that was envisioned in the neighborhood plans that have already been approved or the 20-year plan for growth for King County. That should be a major issue in this fall's campaign because it's a major source, according to polling, of the dissatisfaction with Nickels. But when you have an environmentalist who's very much committed to density as well, it's not really clear what the differentiation with the mayor is going to be with that. So McGinn, in his opening press conference / announcement, did a couple of other issues as a signature issues. One was the claim that Seattle should be taking over the public school system, which is a fine issue to demagogue on because there are a lot of reasons to be upset with Seattle's handling of its schools. The problem is that, number one, the mayor has very little authority over the schools per se, short of taking over the school district itself for the city. And the other problem with that is that in the cities where it's been tried, most notably Philadelphia and Hartford, it's been an unmitigated disaster. It almost certainly is not a good answer to the problems that plague Seattle schools, particularly because it's not so much inefficiency that is the problem with Seattle schools. It's lack of appropriate funding, particularly at the state level. And McGinn gave no understanding that he actually realized that particular problem or was doing anything more than trying to kind of cynically provide some sound bites. The other issue that McGinn focused on was criticizing Metro, which is an agency that, of course, the mayor of Seattle has very little direct control over. So it's not really clear why McGinn is running. He'll certainly have plenty of opportunities to figure it out, but he has certainly a lot of enthusiasm from the environmental community and will get a lot of volunteers from there because it's not entirely clear. This is something else that he wouldn't address during his initial press conference and announcement of where the financing for his campaign is going to come from, given that the business establishment is pretty solidly lined up behind Greg Nickels, and particularly on the signature issue of development, that a lot of the downtown development and business establishment money is already going to Nickels, even though that's also McGinn's agenda. It also seems to be an agenda of the third candidate, James Donaldson, who is best known as a former former basketball player for the Seattle Sonics. Now, why having been a world-class athlete in your 20s makes you qualified 20 or 30 years later to become a mayor of a city is anybody's guess, and you would think we've had enough experience with former newscasters and gossip columnists and whatnot running our city to know that it really isn't very good preparation. But the other major thing that Donaldson seems to be claiming qualifies him to run the city of Seattle is that he has run a small business. Well, as I've run a small business. A lot of people have run small businesses. That doesn't necessarily mean you know how to run a sprawling government agency. The city of Seattle is anything but a small business. But the fact that he didn't do a press conference to announce his candidacy. He appeared on Cairo Radio's Dory Monson show, which is the local home for I'm a right-wing idiot and I'm going to froth at the mouth over some fake outrage that doesn't really mean anything because it's a good chance to bash liberals show. That does not augur well for where Donaldson is coming from in his run for mayor. So we have the ex basketball player, small business owner turned apparent populist. We have the environmentalist who is using non-issues to run because he isn't really in any disagreement with the mayor on his major issues. Oh, with one exception, that's not entirely fair. McGinn has been critical of the tunnel option for the Alaska Way Viaduct. He would prefer to see the surface only option, which is, obviously we agree with them there, but, it's not an ideal situation in terms of the mayor's race. But the flip side of that is that because it's now a three-way race, you have time for it to become a four-way race, and people are still urging Peter Steinbrück, the former city councilman, to run for mayor. He's been playing Hamlet for some time now. Apparently is not real eager to run for mayor himself, but is refusing to run it out just because so many people want him to do it. That decision is better made soon if Steinbrück's going to get off the pot.
Well, isn't the final date that people can jump in sometime in June or July?
Well, yes, it is, but that's legally speaking. You can file any time up through the end of July, but in pragmatic terms, the immense amount of money that's necessary in order to run for mayor, Nichols already has $300,000 in the bank. He raised over $500,000 in 2005, even though he didn't have any credible opposition that year. You really needed to announce before the beginning of the year if you were going to try and be competitive with that kind of money. If you were going to be competitive with a combination of having that kind of money and having a good volunteer base, which is the case for both McGinn and presumably for Steinbrück, you could still do it, but you really can't wait that much longer and have any hope of being able to put together an effective campaign team.
All right. Well, move along and talk about developments with medical marijuana.
Yeah, a case a lot of people have been watching unfolding over in Kitsap County this week with the acquittal of Bruce Olson. He is a medical marijuana patient who, along with his wife, were arrested last year and facing some fairly serious charges for the heinous crime of, for the first time ever, growing exactly one plant. They were charged with growing that plant with the intent to distribute, which the reason this was fairly closely watched, aside from the fact that Olson was very clearly documented, he has some fairly serious chronic health issues, as does his wife. They were both arrested at the same time, both charged with growing to distribute on the same plant. She was forced to plea out, so she's already been convicted. He was actually acquitted by a jury this week. This is the latest in a long story string of cases of this type. This is one of the more egregious of them that have happened in Kitsap County. The prosecutor there has been pretty aggressive about trying to attack medical marijuana patients. Another case that came up that the trial started yesterday of a quadriplegic named Glenn Musgrove. It just makes you wonder, why are we wheeling quadriplegics into the courtroom to try them for growing a plant in the privacy of their own home under state law, which they're authorized to do under state law? It just makes no sense at all. But that those cases are getting almost no attention from what little local media in Seattle remain. You almost have to go, well, the Stranger has been covering it somewhat, at least on Slog, and then of course the Kitsap County media, Bremerton Sun, has been covering it as well. But something that's been watched around the state by medical marijuana advocates who are hoping, certainly under the Obama administration, you've seen the U.S. attorney saying he's not going to prosecute medical marijuana in Washington State or do raids and further anymore, and you would hope that local prosecutors are going to pick up that cue, but so far it doesn't entirely hasn't happened that way.
All right. Excuse me. Moving on to national and this week's economic news.
Yeah, couple large economic announcements this week. First of all, on Monday, Timothy Geithner announcing the Treasury Secretary announcing his long expected plan to buy up toxic assets, the so-called bad bank or bad assets sale that Maria has been talking about for months and months on this show. And it's just about as bad as everybody or we were afraid it was going to be. The stock market was very happy with it, of course, because it's a great deal for them. You're talking about buying up for 60% of assessed value assets that were probably worth no more than 30% of assessed value, and which most observers don't expect will get to anywhere near 60% of assessed value, and won't help provide any of the liquidity that, don't forget, is originally actually needed in order to get the credit markets flowing once again. So that was one problem with it. The larger problem, and this again is something that Maria has been talking about quite a bit. The underlying idea behind the regulatory plan for the toxic debt was the same one that underlied Geithner's plan to regulate the financial derivatives market and the financial markets that came out on Thursday. And that had several good and probably long overdue aspects to it. Derivatives, particularly in the largest banks, will be regulated in the future. It requires a certain number of assets that will have to cover we'll have to cover loans out for firms that are deemed by the federal government to be too big to fail, and the new statutory authority will be given for the feds to be able to take over firms that are concluded to be too big to fail. At the same time, underlying both of these plans, you have a basic problem that is something that Maria's been talking about again for quite some time on this show, that you have these folks trying to pretend that everything will actually be fine with the stock markets. All we have is a basic liquidity problem, that the problem of the actual basic market of derivatives and some of these other financial instruments that were causing the economy to boom in 2005, 2006, that we want to return to those times. We don't want to return to those times. It's a fundamentally flawed model that has the bust in the boom-bust cycle built into it. So now that we've busted, why would you want to go back to a setup for it to bust all over again? That's the direction that these plans take us in, is to going back to that boom-bust model, only to try and go back to the boom time, and doing it with many, many, many hundreds of billions, if not eventually well over $1 trillion in money that will be necessary to help bail out these banks. Again, one of the other things that was not addressed in the regulatory issue was the deregulation in the first place, particularly the Glass-Steagall Act that was repealed in 1999 under the Clinton administration that allowed the banks and insurance and other financial companies to the finance companies all to merge together. Once you have incentives put in place for these enormous financial conglomerates to have their tentacles into all different arenas of the financial market and are simply moving assets from one to another high-risk investment area where they can possibly get a high amount of return, but there's a higher risk. Closing down one area where there's a higher risk, which is how these derivative markets were invented, because they were seen as being high risk but high return, because you're taking very high-risk investments and presumably lessening the risk by spreading that risk out by slicing and dicing them. Well, it just turns out that you don't spread the risk then that after all, because what happens is the banks are willing to then make loans based on fewer and fewer assets. By regulating that particular mechanism for allowing money to flow from one arena to another, you're just creating incentive for these large conglomerates to find other ways to invent financial instruments to go from one money to another. The only way to really put a cap on that is, once again, to separate out or to limit the size of the different financial conglomerates themselves, or the different functions of the financial conglomerate between the banking and insurance and these various other sectors. That was not addressed by the Obama administration. It's not entirely clear, given the globalization of capital that's occurred over the last 10 years, that it's practical to address it at this point. And until that very basic systemic problem is fixed, you're going to continue to have that fundamental weakness in the market.
Who's Geithner proposing to do the regulation?
Oh, that's another problem with this, and thank you for mentioning that. The oversight of who's going to be too big to fail and who's going to require the assets, it's not entirely clear from the plan who it's going to be, but it's probably going to be the Federal Reserve. And that actually is not the federal government itself. That is a private bank that's run, well, basically by the same insiders club that has been run both the Hank Paulson Treasury Department under Bush, and now the Geithner and Larry Summers financial brain trust under Obama. It's basically the same folks, and that again is very much a fox and house kind of situation.
All right, moving on, the EPA making a positive move this week?
Yeah, that didn't happen much over the last 8 years, did it? A very positive news. The Environmental Protection Agency cracking down on mountaintop removal of mines, which has been a huge problem in Appalachia, in a letter to the Army Corps of Engineers for two projects, one in eastern Kentucky, one in West Virginia. The EPA signaling that it's going to oppose future plans to remove, essentially whole mountains are being removed, sluiced through these sophisticated mining operations to try and get trace elements of different minerals, and then the mountaintops are just dumped into the valleys, causing incredible environmental destruction. That has been going on for several years now throughout the Bush administration with a minimum amount of environmental oversight, and the EPA now saying that it's not going to allow that to go unchecked any longer. Very, very good news for that part of the world.
All right. Moving on to international, and the G20 is coming up.
Yeah, it is coming up this very week, in fact, in London. In fact, today was the first very large demonstration as tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, not entirely clear from today's press accounts how many people were in London, but it looked pretty darn large, protesting. Of course, this is a tradition of summit protests that was not begun, but certainly solidified by what we did in Seattle 10 years ago. But this one being larger and probably more notable than usual because of the anger over the economic situation that's happened in Britain and, you know, of course, in the United States and elsewhere. the G20, notable on its own terms for financial reasons this week. Very interesting to see that while the U.S. stock markets were very happy with Timothy Geithner's plan to buy up toxic bank assets, the stock prices of the Dow Jones Industrial and the Standard & Poor's and so forth all rose quite sharply on Tuesday as a result of that. But the value of the dollar did not. Foreign investors taking a longer-term look at the future of the U.S. economy were somewhat dismayed to see the approach that the Obama administration was taking. And there's going to be a real showdown this week between the Obama administration's approach, which has been very much a return to business as usual. All we need to do is shovel money at the banks, and the approach of many of the European countries that has taken place over the last several months, which has been much more toward nationalization of the banks, which again is something Maria's been talking about a lot over the last several months here on the show. This is something that's going to be coming up this week. The other interesting thing that's going to come up, China's central bank calling this past week for an IMF-run global reserve currency. This would be a brand new currency that would replace the dollar as the reserve currency of use around the world. Now, China did not mention the United States by name in this. They were talking about, well, it's not a good idea to rely on any one currency in the global economy, because that enables that country's economy, if it has domestic problems, to take the world's economy down with it. But it was pretty darn obvious who they were referring to. And when this kind of call is coming from the country that is by far your largest creditor, it is not at all a good sign for creditor relations, as it were, as the United States tries to work its way out of its economic situation. So it'll be very interesting to see what kind of talks come out of the G20 this week, and also very interesting to see how the media covers the protests at the G20, whether it's seen as a sign of populist outrage, whether it's seen as the usual rabble that protest summits, whether it's dismissed altogether, or whether it's seen as a legitimate questioning of the financial management that's happened over the past decade, and globalization, and a recognition that the critics have been right all along about the risks of the globalization policies that we've seen. I'm not holding my breath on that last one.
All right. Well, then that moves us on to Afghanistan.
Yeah, this was another major piece of news this week. The Obama administration yesterday releasing its long-awaited plan for how it's going to manage its ramping up of the war in Afghanistan. And for all of the rhetoric that's been given over the last several months to how in Afghanistan we've relied too heavily on a strictly military approach. We need to have a more balanced approach that includes not just military spending, but also spending on nation building and infrastructure and civic investment and so forth. You still have a plan that has a 20 to 1 ratio of military to non-military spending. Now, mind you, that's jaundiced a little bit by the fact that every little toilet seat for the military costs 6 times what it would cost when an NGO buys it, or maybe 600 times. I haven't quite seen the figures. But it's still a real indictment of how heavily wed to a military model our nation's foreign policy establishment is. And there's several major flashpoints coming up in Afghanistan policy that the plan really doesn't address. The counterinsurgency plan that the Obama administration has released on a military basis is not that bad of a plan. It's supposed to have 3 to 5 years in order to plan off, or in order to play out, rather. It's a bad sign when Joe Biden, who has loved every military intervention he's ever seen throughout his long Senate career, was kind of the voice of moderation within the Obama administration on this particular plan. But It didn't deal with several things. One is coordination with how the Obama administration is going to handle the situation in Pakistan, because they're really one situation. The border there is very fluid, as we've talked about quite a bit. The people who are fighting there is a real war going on in Pakistan right now, that it's being fought by the same people who are fighting the war in Afghanistan, essentially. On the Afghanistan side, there's an election coming up in August. That election is likely to see the re-election of U.S. puppet, I mean ally, Herman Karzai, who the U.S. has soured on in recent months, not least because he's running a failed narco state, but there really haven't been any challengers to him that have come forward. Now, that's not as much of an impediment as it would be in this country, because in many countries you can have a challenger come forward in the final months before an election and it still be credible, but it does make a successful challenge to an incumbent less likely. So you have that problem, because if Karzai is in fact reelected, it's likely to be a significant drop in the already tenuous grip on legitimacy that his administration has in the minds of many Afghans. The plan also didn't really address the legitimacy of the military effort in terms of the tremendous amount of civilian casualties that the airstrikes in Afghanistan have had in recent years. Now, putting more troops on the ground decreases the amount of reliance on airstrikes that the NATO forces and the United States will have, but it doesn't mean there's going to be less bombing. It just means there'll be more troops there to supplement it. So you have that crisis of legitimacy, and you still haven't addressed the whole war on drugs issue of trying to eradicate the poppy crops that are the main source of economic benefit, not just for the Taliban, who are only too happy to profit off the drug trade, but also for the vast majority of Afghans who have no other way to make a living. The civic infrastructure that's supposed to create an economic alternative for Afghans is going to take a long time to play out, and in the meantime, those folks still have to make a living. You're still trying to eradicate their crops, and they're still going to be hostile to the U.S. and allied forces as a result. None of those things have really been addressed by the Obama administration's plan, and with those things not being addressed, you're still left with the same basic situation there, which is you're fighting an insurgency type war for no particularly clear reason, where it's not really clear what victory looks like, and in a country where, let's face it, thousands of years worth of invaders have all pretty much successfully been repelled over time, including most recently the Soviets. So it looks like we may be in for another quagmire. Not to put too fine a spin on it.
All right. That leaves us then with events for this week.
Yeah, one big one going on this week, downtown at actually a number of different venues, which is the second annual Green Festival. So if you don't have your tickets yet, go on down there and check it out.
Yeah,
the Trade and Convention Center is sort of ground zero for it, but it's spread out from that to some other venues as well.
All right, yeah, starts at 10 o'clock this morning. Talking as we do every week with Ja Pirsch, co-editor at Eat the State, and tell people about where they can find Eat the State.
Well, Eat the State is a we do this little wrap every week, that it is a fine little local newspaper and website, as well as this radio segment. We publish every couple of weeks, and we can be found wherever you find free newspapers, bookstores, cafes, Kent County Library System, and so forth. You can also find our current issue and all of our back issues online at www.eatthestate.org, and we are in the beginning stages of our fund drive, and it came just in time because, quite frankly, we're broke. So if you value the kind of news that you get on Eat the State, or if you get in the newspaper and you're wondering, well, gee, there just doesn't seem to be that much journalism or that much reporting, and certainly not that much context to the reporting going on in Seattle media anymore, we would like very much to be able to continue to do that, but we can't do it without the support of our readers and listeners, because you know, we're all volunteers. Nobody gets paid. Our biggest expense is the printer. And actually, that's almost our only expense is the printer. And our printer likes to get paid. So if you can donate, please do so. Please help us out at www.eatthestate.org. There's a PayPal button right on there. Or you can send your checks or money orders to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. I'll repeat that again in a moment. We also, of course, because we're all volunteers, we do appreciate volunteer help as well as cash of the financial kind. So if you're interested in writing or if you're interested in distributing or otherwise helping out, give us an email. Email us at editorial or info at eatthestate.org. Actually, info is the better address for that. Info at eatthestate.org. And again, if you can donate, we really, really could use it, especially this week, because we're out of money. And, you know, somehow, some way, our audience always comes through for us. We really appreciate that. But now's the time again. P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145, or online at eatthestate.org.
So literally, your next issue cannot go to print until you guys get some money in.
Well, specifically, until we pay our printer, and somebody's got to pay that printer because we don't have enough money in our bank account right now.